Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1108, Deep Politics and the Death of Iris Chang, Part 2. This is being recorded on January 14th of the year 2020. We are going to jump right in here and continue with our analysis of material from the book Gold Warriors and also material from other sources that are relating to the deep politics that were involved with the forces that Iris Chang had been investigating in her landmark text about the rape of Nanking, and also things that were immediately attendant on the Bataan Death March and other things that Iris had been looking into, as I discussed in For the Record 509 and again at greater detail in our last show, For the Record 1107. I suspect that Iris Chang may very well have been a victim of the MK Ultra and Operation Artichoke style mind control programs, perhaps simply the victim of some cynical and deliberate manipulation of psych medication. We will never know for sure, but she allegedly took her own life, or perhaps actually pulled the trigger, although I suspect under mind control. On November 9th of 2004, about a month later, Gary Webb's two-bullet, quote, suicide took place as well. For details about that, about my suspicions that she may have been under mind control, again, For the Record, 1107 goes into that at some length, and AFA programs 5, 6, and 7, and a linked three-show series from the For the Record programs go into the mind control programs as well. Suffice it to say that people can be programmed to commit suicide. And again, the manipulation of powerful psych drugs, such as the type that Iris was taking, can also be done to affect a person's demise. When I spoke with Sterling Seagrave in 2009, the interview that was in For the Record 689, he opined not on the interview because he didn't want to talk about it, but he felt that Iris Chang's death was murder as well. Now, Iris Chang at the time of her death was working on the story of the Bataan death marches. We went into lawsuits that covered up the refuted attempts by the survivors of the Bataan Death March to get compensation from the Japanese corporations and related interests. Many of those survivors had been bought as slave laborers to Japan. And again, the landmark text, Gold Warriors, by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave, go into the story of Operation Golden Lily and the tremendously powerful forces that were involved in the not only bringing together that wealth, but what happened to it after the war. Among the people who benefited from the $100 billion in 1945 dollars in gold that was secreted in the Philippines alone was Ferdinand Marcos. That sum, again, $100 billion in the Philippines alone. And that was when gold was worth $35 an ounce. It is worth a whole lot more than that now. One of the people who benefited from that was Ferdinand Marcos, who got access to the Golden Lily sites and was able to recover some of that gold. He also collaborated with Japanese, such as Kodama Yoshio and Sasakawa Roichi, people we've gone into in a number of different shows, including AFA program number 7, AFA program number 14, and other broadcasts. When Marcos successfully recovered a lot of the Golden Lily loot in the Philippines, he collaborated with a former Japanese officer who operated under the pseudonym of Ishihara, I-S-H-I-H-A-R-A. That is a common Japanese name, and it was a pseudonym. The Seagraves opine that may well have been a Japanese war criminal named Colonel Tsuji Masanobu. That's capital P-S-U-J-I, last name capital M-A-S-A-N-O-B-U. Again, this is a speculative element. However, this also places the Bataan Death March, which Iris was working on, in the context of the tremendously powerful forces set forth in the book Gold Warriors, with a cover endorsement from Iris Chang and credit given to her in the acknowledgement. From Gold Warriors, about the speculative identity of, quote, Ishihara. One Japanese source told us Ishihara might be the notorious Colonel Tsuji Masanobu, reviled for the Suk Ching massacres of ethnic Chinese in Singapore and Malaya, and for eating an Allied pilot's liver. After Suk Ching, he was sent to Manila as troubleshooter with the rank of Imperial Inspector General. True to form, Tsuji became a key figure responsible for the Bataan Death March, when he bypassed mild-mannered General Homa and urged field officers to murder Allied prisoners during the march. When he was in areas controlled by the Imperial Navy, Tsuji had the Navy rank of captain. In areas controlled by the Army, he changed uniforms and became a colonel. Although he made frequent trips to Tokyo by plane the next 2 years and put in appearances at Guadalcanal and other battles, he is said to have spent most of 1943 and 1944 in Luzon, note that, working with Kadama and keeping an eye on Golden Lily treasure sites in and around Manila. Late in 1944, Tsuji moved to Burma and Siam and was in Bangkok in August of 1945 when Japan surrendered, eluding capture. So again, as to the real identity of Ishihara, we will never know. The Seagraves opine that it may well have been Colonel Tsuji Masanobu, who again was deeply involved with not only the Suk Ching massacres, which we have covered before, and I will link in the description for this program. But Tsuji Masanobu was also involved with the Bataan Death March, which Iris Chang was researching and doing work on at the time of her death. Now, when Iris Chang committed suicide, whether she actually pulled the trigger or, as I suspect, was programmed to do that, a la MK Ultra, George W. Bush was president of the U.S. And as we will see, George W. Bush and his father, George H. W. Bush, for whom CIA headquarters is named, are involved with a multi-generational deep political milieu that is in turn inextricably linked with a tremendous amount of gold in the Philippines and the recovery and use of that gold by various people, including former President George H.W. Bush and W. Bush as well. Early into George W. Bush's administration, in March of 2001, there are reports that he was using the Navy to obtain gold from the Philippines, including the area of Luzon, where Tsuji Masanobu was reported to have been, for his blind trust of George W. Bush and his alleged recovery of gold from the Philippines. The Seagraves write as follows in Gold Warriors. In March of 2001, only weeks into the new Bush administration, two U.S. Navy ships arrived in the Philippines carrying teams of SEAL commandos. According to a source at the U.S. Embassy, they were sent to the Philippines to recover gold as part of a plan to enlarge America's reserves. This gold, the embassy source said, would come from two places: new excavations of Yamashita gold vaults and the purchase, at a deep discount, of Japanese loot already recovered and held in private vaults by wealthy Filipinos. One of the two ships sailed on to Mindanao to take on a load of bullion the embassy source said was owned by the family of the new president, Gloria Macabal Arroyo. President Bush, the source said, was being aggressive, unquote. The buzz among gold hunters in Luzon was that associates of President Bush and his family were privately in the market to buy some of the bullion still being recovered from Golden Lily sites. Parenthetically, this in addition to actually recovering some of the gold to bolster U.S. gold reserves. Beginning again, the buzz among gold hunters in Luzon was that associates of President Bush and his family were privately in the market to buy some of the bullion still being recovered from Golden Lily sites. One of the many names dropped by gold bugs in Manila was that of East Texas oil billionaire William Stamps Farish, F-A-R-I-S-H, an intimate friend and fishing companion of the Bush family. Will Farish, who raises horses in Kentucky and is board chairman of Churchill Downs, where the Kentucky Derby is staged, had just been nominated by President Bush to be America's new ambassador to the Court of St. James, where he was a personal friend of Queen Elizabeth. The buzz had special resonance because Will Farish is said to be the manager of President Bush's blind trust. Again, according to the Seagraves, Navy forces, not only Navy ships, but elite SEAL commandos were being used to recover some of the Golden Lily loot still being unearthed or recovered in the Philippines, plus some that was being held in private vaults by the Filipinos. And some of the recovered gold was also to be used for George W. Bush's private trust. Note that this was in part in the Luzon area where Tsuji Masanobu is reported to have been involved with Golden Lily. The name William Stamps Farish was one that resonates in our archives. We're going to go back by way of examining deep politics. We are going to go back into the archives roughly 40 years and listen to a short section of Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, much of which was then recapped as, for the record, 5/11. This was recorded in May, specifically on May 23rd of 1980. And in addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Mark Ortiz. And what we are talking about here is a very important series of cartel agreements between IG Farben and Standard Oil of New Jersey. So here again from AFA number, from Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, and for the record, 5/11.
Perhaps the single most important contribution that an American firm made to the Nazi war effort was the technology transfer effected from Standard Oil of New Jersey to the giant German chemical cartel of IG Farben. There are three areas that we're going to focus on in our discussion. The first concerned Standard IG cooperation with regard to the hydrogenation process, through which oil is derived or synthesized from coal. The second concerns the transfer of isooctane and tetraethyl lead technology to the Nazis. And the third concerns the transfer of butyl rubber technology to the Nazis. Each of these was essential for the prosecution of modern warfare.
Well, explain just how essential.
Beginning with the hydrogenation process, it's important to note that the Blitzkrieg, Hitler's motorized columns and closely integrated Air Force units, obviously demanded a lot of fuel. Germany has no domestic oil reserves to speak of, and as such, the prosecution of modern war by Germany was dependent on the synthesizing of fuels. The hydrogenation process by which oil is synthesized from coal, Germany has very plentiful coal reserves, was developed through cooperation between Standard Oil and IG Farben in the 1926 through 29 period. In 1929, Standard and IG formed the so-called Standard IG Agreement, which provided for the formation of the Standard IG Company. This was a research company, which was owned 80% by Standard Oil and 20% by IG. Now, what they each got from this agreement that was important was the following. Standard was afraid that eventually IG's synthetic oil might threaten their worldwide preeminence in the oil market. So they sought to eliminate IG as a world competitor. They did not want to have to compete with IG synthetic oil. IG, by the same token, had sunk so much capital into the development of the hydrogenation process that they were actually threatened by this amount, by the amount of the investment. If they were not able to obtain capital, it is quite probable that IG as a company might have had to dissolve, and this would have been absolutely fatal for Hitler's war-making effort. So what Standard obtained from IG was an agreement, or the, an agreement really, that Standard would have the rights for the worldwide marketing of oil synthesized under the hydrogenation process, except in Germany, so that IG was still in the position to develop, to manufacture and market synthetic oil in Germany. This, however, served Standard's purpose of eliminating IG and their synthetic oil as a competitor. In return, IG not only retained the rights to manufacture synthetic oil for Germany, but more importantly, they received 2% of Standard Oil's stock. That was a total of $35 million, and this piece of capital was absolutely essential for the continued functioning of IG Farben. Without that capital, it's quite possible that IG Farben would have dissolved. Had IG Farben dissolved, the Third Reich would have dissolved and World War II would not have happened. The second area in which Standard Oil provided IG Farben with an absolutely critical element in war production concerned the transfer of iso-octane and tetraethyl lead.
Basically, the significance of that is that this information and the patents involved in it enabled the Germans to make good quality gas for their road vehicles and, most importantly, for their airplanes. Iso-octane is one of the substances that's used to test gasoline, and it is from iso-octane that we derive the octane numbers that rate the quality of gasoline that you see on the gas pump. Standard taught IG Farben and the Germans about iso-octane and about its good anti-knock properties in engines, and taught them how to make it and use it in testing gasoline. Tetraethyl lead, as many of you are probably aware, is an effective anti-knock additive to gasoline. By putting just a small amount of tetraethyl lead in gasoline, its tendency to knock in an engine is drastically reduced. That enables you to build the engine with a higher compression ratio that makes the engine more efficient. It makes more power from less fuel, and it weighs less and takes up less room doing it. Translating that to an airplane, it means that you need good high-octane gasoline to build a competitively fast, high-flying, long-range airplane. In other words, without this technology, Germany could never have fielded a competitive air force in World War II.
Tetraethyl lead was developed in the United States by the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation. That was jointly owned by both Standard Oil and General Motors, 50% ownership by each firm. IG Farben requested the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation to provide them with the patent technology and the technical know-how to enable them to manufacture their own tetraethyl lead. The War Department got wind of the negotiations between Ethyl Gasoline and IG and wrote a letter to Mr. Webb, the General Motors official who was president of the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation, and pointed out that providing Germany with tetraethyl technology would be giving them an absolutely essential war-making item, an absolutely a vital war commodity, and that basically they should not do so under any circumstances, because obviously this would have grave implications for the United States and its allies, or potential allies. So Mr. Webb then wrote the Defense Department, said, don't worry, we won't do that, and then turned right around and provided IG with tetraethyl lead. The granting of the tetraethyl license to IG, and this is important, was the first time that such a license was granted to any competitor outside of the United States. And it's also interesting to note that IG was not able to manufacture enough tetraethyl lead from their plants in order to meet Hitler's timetable for the invasion of Poland. So instead, the Ethyl Gasoline Corporation loaned them 500 tons of tetraethyl lead so that they could proceed with the invasion of Poland. Also sold them $20 million worth of aviation gasoline
containing tetraethyl lead.
And so as a result, Hitler's timetable was not disrupted. Interestingly enough, the collateral for this loan, which was forfeited by IG, was arranged through Brown Brothers Harriman and Company, a firm involving the Harriman brothers, W. Averill Harriman, but more importantly, his younger brother, E. Roland Harriman. And the iso-octane technology was also the first, the providing of iso-octane by Standard to IG was the first time that an iso-octane license had been granted outside of the United States as well.
One point I'd like to interject, again relating this to the present, this ethyl gasoline corporation that sold this tetraethyl lead was a joint venture half owned by General Motors, half owned by Standard Oil. Again, with this plus the company that arranged the financing, we see the activities of an interlocking network of corporate power and corporation owner power that exists to this day and still functions throughout the world.
The third area in which Standard Oil provided Nazi Germany through IG Farben with an essential war component concerned the transfer of the technology for making butyl rubber.
Now, butyl rubber is a common ingredient in tires, but until the late 30s it wasn't known. Butyl rubber, apart from the fact that you don't have to have access to rubber trees in order to obtain it, is also a non-porous rubber. Most rubber has little pores in it, and if you make an inner tube or a rubber raft out of normal rubber, natural rubber, or most kinds of synthetic rubber, the air will leak out after a while, even if there are no ruptures or holes in the part that you made. However, butyl rubber is exceptionally good for sealing, so it's a common choice for inner tubes, tires, life rafts, fuel bladders, but lots of things, anything that has to contain air. There was also another kind of rubber involved in this, which was Buna rubber.
B-U-N-A, by the way.
Which is still available in the United States. It's Buna is actually a trademark. The name of that kind of rubber is nitrile rubber. Neoprene, which you may have on the soles of your shoes, is related to that. Also, the main important property of Buna rubber is its resistance to petroleum and petroleum-related chemicals. So it's very important for fuel bladders in airplanes, gaskets, seals, hoses, anything that has to resist anything that's made out of oil. Now, what happened with the Buna process is the Germans developed it, and while the Germans got access to the American butyl process, the Americans did not get access to the German Buna process.
Basically, how this worked out, in 1930, Standard and IG arrived at the so-called JASCO agreement, J-A-S-C-O, referring to the Joint American Study Corporation. JASCO was owned 50% by IG, 50% by Standard Oil. What this did was to, it was basically a cartel agreement, which assured that Standard would not interfere with IG's exclusive province, which was chemicals, and that IG in turn would not interfere with Standard Oil's oil business. Now, under the terms of the JASCO agreement in 1938, Standard Oil provided the Nazis through IG Farben with all of the butyl patents and technical know-how. They requested the Buna patents and know-how in return. And finally, after the outbreak of war in Europe, they received the Buna patents, or Buna patents. How is that pronounced?
Buna if you're German, Buna if you're American.
That sounds like Buna to me. Okay, so they received the Buna patents, but they never received the Buna technical know-how, without which the patents were really not that effective, so that it was a clear case of where Standard restricted the development of an essential component of modern warfare in this country and provided the Nazis with an equally essential element under the terms of that same agreement.
That began from Miscellaneous Archive Show M11 from May 23rd of 1980. Now, turning to the book American Dynasty by Kevin Phillips, copyright 2004 by Kevin Phillips, and published in hardcover by Viking Penguin. Kevin Phillips, by the way, was a conservative, a real conservative. That word is badly abused now. The vast majority of people calling themselves conservatives at this point are fascists. And, however, Kevin Phillips is happily an exception. And he eventually wrote a series of books which took the status quo to task, one of them, American Dynasty, about the Bush family. And he wrote here, In early March of 1942, a special Senate committee began public hearings on cartel agreements between U.S. and German firms. Before long, William S. Farish, that's William S. Farish I, the chairman of Standard Oil of New Jersey, had pleaded no contest to charges of criminal conspiracy between his company and I.G. Farben. In keeping with cartel agreements, Standard had withheld from U.S. authorities information on the production of artificial rubber. That, again, in connection with the agreements between Standard Oil New Jersey and I.G. Farben, which you heard set forth in Miscellaneous Archive Show M11. Now, that William Stamps Farish is William Stamps Farish I. We're going to go back now to Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, and we're going to hear a short excerpt that talks about how the people who were put in charge in military positions for the, quote, reconstruction of, quote, unquote, of Germany actively frustrated attempts at breaking up these cartel agreements. Now, before we continue, let's go back once again roughly 40 years into the archives to May 23rd, 1980, and listen to a section of Miscellaneous Archive Show M11.
Together with Norman Bursler and Alexander Sachs, I was walking through the hall of a temporary wooden office building when Alex pointed to the name of Colonel Graham K. Howard over the office door of the director of the Economics Division. Howard was the author of a book written in 1940 before the United States entered the war called America and a New World Order, an apologia for the Nazi economic system that might just as well have been titled You Can Do Business with Hitler. Now it looked as though we were to be working with him and others like him in an effort to reconstitute Germany on a new pattern. Colonel Howard was only the first of many who turned up, riding into Germany with a future military government, helping to deflect the policy back into the old grooves. Colonel Howard, it is true, was straightaway relieved of his duties before we left Bushy Park for the continent. In fact, just after General Wickersham received a copy of his book from the Intelligence Division. But trick pennies are the same on both sides. The position of economic director was filled by the assignment from Washington of Brigadier General William H. Draper, Jr., on military leave from his position as Secretary Treasurer of Dillon, Reed & Company. This investment banking firm after World War I had taken the lead in floating the German bonds, which put German industry in a position to fight another war. The men with whom Colonel Howard had already staffed the Economics Division clearly wanted the occupation of Germany to be carried out along quite different lines from those decided upon by the government departments at Washington.
Okay, that began from Miscellaneous Archive Show M11. And by way of understanding deep politics, we're going to go back to the book American Dynasty by Kevin Phillips. You heard about William Stamps Farish III, and about William Draper, then Brigadier General William Draper, deeply involved with Dillon Reed that helped to promote American investment in Germany. Note, by the way, in the agreement between Standard Oil of New Jersey and I.G. Farben about tetraethyl lead, the collateral laid down and forfeited for that went through Brown Brothers Harriman. Both Prescott Bush Sr. and George Herbert Walker, the father and grandfather of George H.W. Bush, and the great-grandfather and grandfather of George W. Bush, sat on the board of Brown Brothers Harriman. Turning once again to American Dynasty by Kevin Phillips. In any event, a surprising number of the descendants of men who had dealt with Germany, William S. Farish III, parenthetically, allegedly the fellow who was overseeing George W. Bush's blind trust, for which some of the Golden Lily gold from the Philippines was allegedly being recruited, William S. Farish III, beginning again. In any event, a surprising number of the descendants of men who had dealt with Germany, William S. Farish III, William Draper III, and Joseph Vernor Reed, Jr., grandson of Remington Orange Chairman Samuel Pryor, earlier a director of both UBC and American Ship and Commerce, turned up as close personal advisors or high-level appointees in the George H.W. Bush administration. by the way, and for the record, 475, we remember Samuel Pryor Sr. He was a director at Union Banking Corporation, which was a Thiessen property, and the parent bank of that, the Bank for Humboldt and Schaeffart in the Netherlands, was used by Fritz Thiessen, the German steel baron, for some of his early financing of the fledgling Nazi party in Germany. And in an essay by John Loftus that we have looked at, and that was excerpted in one of the series I did, in the three-program series I did, for the records, 58, 59, and 60, yes. We went into how it was Brown Brothers Harriman on which the Bush, Prescott Bush, and George Herbert Walker sat, on whose board George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush sat, that channeled American capital into Nazi Germany. And then when Operation Safe Haven went into effect, it was the Union Banking Corporation that helped to get the money out. And Prescott and George Herbert Walker Sr. sat on the board of those two. I think George Herbert Walker may have passed away. No, I think he was still alive at that point. But a note that Joseph Pryor sat on the board of UBC and American Ship and Commerce, the parent company of the Hamburg America Line, another of the Bush family Nazi-linked businesses, and one that may well have been used to ship Remington arms to the Nazi Party in the early 1930s. It was Remington arms that were to be used in the 1934 coup attempt, and the chief selection, as we looked at in For the Record 448 and 475, and also in AFA program number 10, the fellow initially selected to head up the 34 coup attempt to overthrow Franklin Delano Roosevelt was Douglas MacArthur. And it was, of course, Douglas MacArthur who put down the bonus marchers who were marching on Washington, D.C., veterans of World War One who wanted to be paid the bonus that they were promised for enlisting in World War One. It had never been given to them and was still not given to them. Douglas MacArthur, with regular army troops backed by tanks, crushed the bonus marchers. And it was the grandson of Samuel Pryor who served as a high-level appointee or advisor to George H.W. Bush. Now, what we're going to do next is to take a look at Harkin Energy. That is a company on whose board George W. Bush sat. And as we will see, it appears to have been one of the many funny money fronts that the Bush family has been involved with, and may very well have been a vehicle for recycling some of the Golden Lily loot from the Philippines. Now, the deep politics here is more than a little interesting. We'll go into that. The head of Harkin Energy, eventually Bush became a director of Harkin Energy. The fellow who became the head of Harkin Energy was a lawyer named Alan Quasha, Q-U-A-S-H-A. His father, William Quasha, had been an attorney in the Philippines, one of whose clients was the CIA-linked Nguyen-Han Bank that we went into at great length in AFA program number 25. William Quasha, interestingly enough, had been in the Philippines, and Douglas MacArthur, when he returned to the Philippines after the war, appointed William Quasha to be in charge of alien property, basically the Philippines equivalent of alien property custodian. Among the alien property in the Philippines was this incredible aggregation of gold, precious stones, etc., which became the foundation of so much of not only the covert operations structure, but so much else in clandestine politics and even the world economy as a whole. So again, William Quasha was the father of Alan Quasha, who became the head of Harkin. George W. Bush was on the board of directors of Harkin, which appears to have been a funny money company. More deep politics later. And recall that after the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th of 2002, a guy named Talat Osman, who was a director of Harkin Energy, interceded directly with then-Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, as we looked at in Further Record 356 and 357, on behalf of the individuals and institutions raided by FBI, Treasury, and others for having financed international terrorism, including Al-Qaeda. Altman was a close friend and political advisor of both Georges Bush, was a protege of Gaït Faron of the BCCI. That is how he wound up on the board of Harkin Energy. And Paul O'Neill was fired as Treasury Secretary, or left under duress, in about, oh, that was December, about 9 months, maybe 8 months later. Actually, that would have been early April, but 7 months later. The fellow who basically proved to be less than vigorous in the investigation of the BCCI was Robert Mueller, who at this point in time headed up the FBI. Time permitting, more about that later. But remember about Harkin Energy and the role of George, that company in the rise of George W. Bush, and as we will see, the deep political connections that go back to the Philippines and Alan Quasha, William Quasha, Douglas MacArthur, and as we will see, we're going to hear about some interesting names who were advisors to Ferdinand Marcos at the point in time when he was recovering Golden Lily loot. And spoiler alert, Paul Manafort, Donald Trump's campaign manager and longtime GOP dirty trickster Roger Stone, who appears to have been an intermediary with Julian Assange and helped to release information on the eve of the Democratic Convention in 2016, which then sent the Bernie bots into overdrive, and they helped to do to the Democratic Convention in 2016 what the McCarthy supporters did in 1968, and one of the reasons why Donald Trump is president today. However, we're going to turn now to the book Family of Secrets by Russ Baker, published in the soft cover by the Bloomberg Press. I interviewed Russ Baker in For the Record program number 710 through 716. Anyway, that will be linked in the description for this program. And writing of Harkin Energy and the mysterious sources of funds for Harkin Energy, many of which may have come from the Golden Lily recoveries in the Philippines under Marcos, Russ Baker writes as follows. In September of 1986, as oil prices continued to collapse and W's previous financial savior, the Cincinnati-based Spectrum 7 Energy, was itself failing, along came the Dallas-based Harkin, a comparatively little-known independent oil and gas company, riding to the rescue. Harkin snapped up Spectrum, put W on its board of directors, and gave him a handsome compensation package. In return, W was allowed to go about his business, which at the time meant playing a crucial role in his father's presidential campaign. But the Harkin assist didn't just benefit Poppy's political fortunes. Profits from W's subsequent sale of Harkin stock would jack up his own political career. The Harkin deal ultimately made it possible for him to become part owner and highly visible managing director, unquote, of the popular Texas Rangers baseball team, a position that would enhance his modest resume as a candidate for governor a few years later. Thus, the largesse of the figures behind Harkin played a key role in George W. Bush's quick march to the presidency. Virtually everyone who has looked at Harkin over the years agrees that it is some strange kind of corporate beast, like a newly discovered species of manatee. The company's books have never made any sense to outsiders, which might have had something to do with the fact that the only people who seemed to make any money were the insiders. In 1991, Time magazine proclaimed Harkin, quote, one of the most mysterious and eccentric outfits ever to drill for oil, unquote. The Harkin story itself reads at times like the stuff of an airport bookstore thriller. One finds figures associated with BCCI, gold caches, and an alphabet soup of secret societies appearing at critical junctures to bail out Harkin. Now, we're going to look at some of the deep politics involved between Harkin and the Bush family and the Philippines. Now, note here that Poppy Bush appears to have been affiliated with naval intelligence and intelligence activities during World War II, including at the Philippines. Later, when he was serving as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, he lived next door to Douglas MacArthur's widow, as we looked at in For the Record 448 and also in AFA program number 10. Douglas MacArthur married the daughter of Edward Stotesbury, who was a key Morgan partner and also a financier of domestic fascist organizations. The source for that, by the way, is for Stotesbury Financing Fascism, is the book A Thousand Americans by George Selbes. And also note that Douglas MacArthur's widow contributed money to George W. Bush's congressional campaign. So the deep politics connecting Poppy Bush, George H.W. Bush, for whom CIA headquarters is named, and George W. Bush to the evolution of the Philippine War Gold, and as we will see, Douglas MacArthur and Ferdinand Marcos. Well, this goes back many, many decades. Returning to the book Family of Secrets by Ross Baker. Poppy Bush himself doesn't talk much about the Philippines, but he, too, did service there. Among other things, he participated in numerous bombing runs over the islands when they were in Japanese hands, including Manila Harbor as part of MacArthur's effort to retake the territory. And, of course, there was his intelligence work. As noted in Chapter 2, on his way to the Pacific, Poppy stopped off at Pearl Harbor for some FaceTime with officers assigned to the Joint Intelligence Center for the Pacific Ocean Areas, or JICPOA. The early incarnation of JICOA was headed by Admiral Roscoe Hillenkoetter, H-I-L-L-E-N-K-O-E-T-E-R, who would, after the war, become the director of the CIA. JICPOA remains little known and little discussed, but it was a crucial development in wartime intelligence and played a key role in Admiral Chester Nimitz's successful island-hopping campaign, of which Poppy Bush was a part. Franklin Roosevelt created the Office of Strategic Services, or OSS, in July of 1942 to replace a previous intelligence system that was deemed ineffective. General MacArthur, however, barred the OSS from operating in the Philippines, so that battleground became pretty much his own show. Thus, Bush became a part of a joint intelligence effort coordinated with MacArthur's command. The association with the Bush circle would date back to the days when Douglas MacArthur was a young man, and his mother contacted E.H. Harriman, father of Prescott's future business partners, to ask the railroad tycoon to give her son a job. Years later, when Poppy Bush became the U.N. ambassador, he took an apartment next to Mrs. Douglas MacArthur, and in 1978, MacArthur's widow contributed to W.'s Midland, Texas congressional campaign. Even before Douglas MacArthur commanded U.S. troops in the country, he had major holdings in the largest Philippine gold mine. MacArthur's staff officer, Major General Courtney Whitney, had been an executive of several gold mining companies before the war. Besides the indigenous gold, a great fortune in gold booty was buried in the Philippines, seized by the Japanese as they plundered one East Asian country after another. Several journalists who have spent combined decades on the Philippines gold story, assert that the cache was actually seized by American forces under MacArthur and that its very existence is a sensitive secret. Skipping down. At the end of the war, MacArthur appointed William Quasha, capital Q-U-S-H-A, as Alien Property Administrator. Alien property, unquote, would have included anything of value captured by the Japanese. One more pun. At the end of the war, MacArthur appointed William Quasha as Alien Property Administrator. Alien property, unquote, would have included anything of value captured by the Japanese. Authors Sterling Seagrave and Peggy Seagrave contend that the United States did locate the Japanese gold and used it to fund anti-communist operations the world over. Investigators in the Philippines have said that the gold was stashed in bank vaults in 42 countries. Some of the money was used in Japan to quickly re-establish the ruling clique and a pro-U.S. ruling party, the Liberal Democratic Party. MacArthur oversaw the post-war occupation of Japan. The administrator of the M Fund that secretly channeled these monies to Tokyo was none other than Poppy Bush friend and CIA officer Alfred C. Ulmer. We went into the M Fund, by the way, in For the Record program number 446 and came back to it in 451. Sterling Seagrave talked about the M Fund in For the Record program 689 and Peggy in For the Record 428. So again, note here what William Quasha was involved with. He was appointed as Alien Property Administrator by Douglas MacArthur in the Philippines, and that would have included the Golden Lily loot. Now, we're going to look at some of the deep politics here. Bear in mind that Ferdinand Marcos was actively recovering a great deal of Golden Lily loot from the Philippines in combination with Kadami Yoshio, the point man in Japanese organized crime for many, many years, and for the CIA, who helped to finance the formation of the Japanese LDP from his own war loot-derived stash. And also Sasakawa Roichi. We've looked at the two of them in many programs, including AFA 7 and the aforementioned programs For the Record 969 and 970. Now, at the time when Marcos was recovering Golden Lily loot in combination with Japan and with the U.S., although he didn't come up with as much as the U.S. wanted, that's why he was overthrown, take a look at who was networking with Ferdinand Marcos when he was recovering Golden Lily loot. Returning once again, the Family of Secrets. And again, the best story about Ferdinand, the best documentation of Ferdinand Marcos and the Golden Lily loot, Gold Warriors by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave. And bear in mind that the mysterious Ishihara, who was the pivot man for Marcos's recovery of Golden Lily, may well have been Tsuji Masanobu, who was involved in addition to Golden Lily with the Bataan Death March, which Iris Chang was researching at the time of her death. Turning once again to Family of Secrets by Ross Baker. Poppy Bush and Ferdinand Marcos cultivated a relationship of mutual appreciation. Quote, "We love your adherence to democratic principles," Poppy gushed during a visit to Manila in 1981. Marcos knew how to play the anti-communist card, and like nearly all U.S. leaders, Poppy avidly helped prop up the dictator. A number of Poppy's lieutenants, including Lee Atwater, Paul Manafort, and the notorious dirty trickster Roger Stone, no relation to Robert Stone Jr., did political consulting for Marcos. Because Paul Manafort became Trump's campaign manager and was deeply involved with the EU Association Agreement. One wonders if perhaps some of the money that turned up in some of those mysterious accounts he was operating may have come originally from recycled Golden Lily loot. And, of course, Roger Stone, deeply involved with helping to destabilize Hillary Clinton's campaign, and he was the fellow who was networking with Julian Assange. One more time. A number of Poppy's lieutenants, including Lee Atwater, Paul Manafort, and the notorious Murphy trickster Roger Stone, no relation to Robert Stone Jr., did political consulting for Marcos. Ed Rollins, the manager of the Reagan-Bush 1984 re-election campaign, admitted that the top Filipino politician illegally delivered $10 million in cash from Marcos to Reagan's 1984 campaign, though he declined to name him. Poppy also is known to have personally urged Ferdinand Marcos to invest money in the U.S. Imelda has claimed that Poppy urged her husband to put, quote, his, unquote, funds into something that Imelda knew only as the Communist Takeover Fund. That suggests that gold in the Philippines has long been seen as a funding vehicle for off-the-books intelligence, covert operations, weapons trafficking, and even coups, plus protection money that Marcos felt he had to pay. If all this gold was going somewhere, we have to ask, was some of it going into Harkin Energy, where George W. Bush was deeply involved? Certainly, Alan Quasher had a relationship with his father that somewhat paralleled that of W. and Poppy's. Having remained in the Philippines after the war, William Quasher eventually attained the rarefied status as the only American licensed to practice law there. He also picked up some intriguing clients, including the CIA-tied Nguyen Han Bank. He was well off and well connected with capital sources. In the final days of the Marcos reign, after nearly all the expatriates had abandoned him, Quasher continued to stick by his man, leading the American Chamber of Commerce to condemn his, quote, partisan approach, unquote. He may also have been Marcos' money man, just as Phil Kendrick had heard. Philippine investigators seeking to track the billions Marcos had embezzled from the Philippine Treasury or obtained as bribes found that most of the money had been moved overseas through intermediaries. During the years William Quasher was living in Manila and conducting his law practice, his son Alan attended Harvard Law School and Harvard Business School, even studying in years that overlapped W's time there. Then, Alan Quasher set up a law practice specializing in the alchemy of corporate restructuring. News reports have characterized his approach to acquiring companies on the cheap as bottom-feeding, and noted that the provenance of the funding was not always clear. Additionally, at the time of the Harkin purchase, Poppy Bush, a former CIA director, was vice president with a portfolio for managing covert operations, an empire that was undergirded by laundered intelligence funds. When Alan Quasher took control of Harkin in 1983, he was essentially an unknown and a small-timer. Several years later, he appeared to be on top of the world. Did gold and or Marcos's billions have anything to do with this? Of course, that would involve Golden Lily loot in the Philippines. And Harkin Energy and people connected with it, such as Talat Otman, also figure in Operation Green Quest and the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th of 2002. And that goes directly to September 11th. Bear in mind that Iris Chang's, quote, suicide, unquote, whether or not she actually pulled the trigger, I think she had been programmed or manipulated, was in November 9th of 2004, when the entire September 11th imbroglio was very much in play, so to speak. And George W. Bush, whose links to many of these, to this entire concatenation we have just looked at. In For the Record, program number 569, we took a look, at the experience of Rita Katz, a.k.a. Anonymous, who wrote the book Terrorist Hunter, published in hardcover by CCC, an imprint of HarperCollins, and she was involved with the Operation Green Quest raids. And we're going to take a look at her experience, and bear in mind that the head of the FBI at this point in time was Robert Mueller. And John Canfield here, by the way, is a pseudonym for John Loftus, whom we have looked at in connection with the Operation Green Quest raids in the past. From Terrorist Hunter, and I'll note the parallels between Rita Katz's experience and what Iris Chang was undergoing in the last year to 2 years of her life. For 2 months after the raids, I didn't hear a word from Green Quest. Then one day, Mark suddenly called and asked to see me. "Why?" I said cynically. "Your investigation is over. You don't need me anymore." He understood. "Please don't be cross," he said. "I couldn't talk to you. I, too, was under investigation." He was one of Rita's government contacts. "I was being followed, my phones were tapped, and I was questioned. I was miserable. They gave me a very hard time. Please don't give me any more grief. I don't deserve it." What was this, I thought? Another rerun of the story of John Canfield, a.k.a. John Loftus? What's wrong with these people who keep investigating the investigators? "If you don't believe me," he continued, "talk to the U.S. attorney you work with. He'll tell you. He and everyone else on the team were under investigation." Mark, I knew, was not the guy to make something like that up, but I was curious, and I called the U.S. attorney to get his take. I didn't press him too much because the whole thing was and probably still is under investigation. But he did verify everything Mark told me. Practically everyone involved with the SAR investigation had been under surveillance. The FBI was among the agencies conducting that investigation. The FBI continues to refuse to give Green Quest documents needed for its investigation. The FBI treats Green Quest worse than it does the enemy. By the way, the head of that at the time was Robert Mueller. Now, as I write these lines, the FBI is trying to take over the investigation altogether. Once again, a replay of the story with Samuel Arian and with John Canfield, a.k.a. John Loftus. The FBI claims that Customs and Green Quest were rightfully the ones to initiate the investigation when it seemed to be about money laundering. But now it's become a terrorism-related matter. Customs is incapable, you see, of dealing with it. Isn't that peachy? Judging by what the FBI did with other investigations, if it indeed succeeds in taking over the SAR probe, we can all kiss this investigation goodbye. How many terrorism-related successes can the FBI take credit for? Not too many, that's for sure. Yet the FBI wasn't the worst part in that sticky affair. The CIA was. The CIA was investigating me and the SAR investigators from Green Quest and Customs. The CIA and the FBI investigated everyone who had anything to do with the SAR investigation. White vans and SUVs with dark windows appeared near all of the homes of the SAR investigators. All agents, some of whom were very experienced with surveillance, knew they were being followed. So was I. I felt that I was being followed everywhere and watched at home in the supermarket on the way to work. And for what? Now, I was being watched 24/7. It's a terrible sensation to know you have no privacy and no security. That strange clicking of the phones that wasn't there before, the oh-so-crudely opened mail at home in the office, and the same man I spied in my neighborhood supermarket who was also on the train I took to Washington a week ago. Life can be miserable when you know that someone's always breathing down your neck. The customs agents were questioned, so were their supervisors, so was the U.S. attorney on the SAR case. And compare that experience with what Iris Chang went through and what she was experiencing. It is almost identical, however. Rita Katz and some of the other people involved in Operation Green Quest were experienced with investigation and knew something about the intelligence community. And some of Rita's associates knew about surveillance. But again, this is strikingly similar to what Chang was experiencing, and note that the story of Harkin Energy heavily overlaps the Operation Green Quest raids and the cover-up of same by then-head of the FBI, Robert Mueller. That pretty much concludes things. I will be talking about more current matters. I hope this has given people an insight into some of the deep politics we have been going through, and again, this is dedicated to Sterling Seagrave, Peggy Seagrave, and Iris Chang. Thank you for your lives at work. And rest in peace, brave warriors. This concludes For the Record program number 1108, Deep Politics and the Death of Iris Chang, Part 2, being recorded on January 14th of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.